We'll call this meeting to order. We don't have a quorum, but it's time to get all the testimony over here. If they want to hear it, they better be here. And first of all, Mahoney's. We haven't had the author just walked in.
Can I just sit right here?
You can just sit right there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Mahoney, we don't have a quorum, so we can't move your bill, but we will as soon as we do.
It might be great, Mr. Chair, and if one of the pages wants to pass some of this out.
How's it going?
Good.
Oh, okay.
We can't even repair the bill. I have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So the bill, the amendment's being passed out, or you have it here already?
I think I sent it down to the committee. It should be the O2. It's just a very small amendment. We'll get to that when we get a few more people here.
Yep.
Mr. Chair and committee, there's some people here on this committee who were not here last year, so just a little bit of context on House File 102. Last year we passed the Angel Investment Tax Credit. It's probably one of the premier credits in the nation. This year created approximately $30 million for small companies and startups. Angels are companies that investors that it's very high risk. This House File 102 is the logical next step in that process. It takes the Science and Technology Authority that we created last year in legislation and empowers it with its to put into play its strategic plan that they came up with, and then fund it. Now, the funding source, although it would be nice to be in this committee, is likely to be addressed in taxes more than it is in this bill anyhow than any place else.
That's what we're going to refer it to.
That's where we would like to refer it to once we get a quorum. So, Mr. Chair, I will briefly go through the bill. Take me about 15 minutes. And then I've got a couple of testifiers, and then you can answer any questions that you'd like.
Very well.
House File 102, page 1 is primarily, or section 1 is primarily definitions. There's two definitions that I would like to highlight. Base year taxation, which is likely to be more addressed in the tax committee, but I'd like members to understand what it is. What we're doing with this is we have, I think it's 16 job classifications underneath the North American Industrial Classification System. In other words, it breaks down to about 7,000 companies out of the 160,000 in the state. They have a taxable wage base for the year that I'm going to use. I think it's 2007. They had a $12.5 billion wage base. The next year was about $500 million more. What this bill does in this base year taxation sets that up to take that $500 million in increased wages and the taxes paid on that, and then take 85% to fund the Science and Technology Authority. So what this definition is, it's just defining the what you would call a base year taxation. And then on page 2, Subdivision 9.
Representative Mahoney, we do have a quorum now, so if you'd like to move your bill.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 102 to be passed and referred to taxes as amended. Well, as amended.
Now, you want to put your amendment on now?
I would love to put my amendment on at the present time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the amendment, I can't remember which page it is on. I don't have a copy of it at hand.
Page 6, line 18.
Right. One of the, in state government, there was a concern that there was no, thank you, there was no limit to what could be used for administrative costs. So this puts a limit on the overhead. So it says the first $5 million uses 5% for overhead, and any after that is 2%. So what we're trying to do is run a pretty lean machine. Mm-hmm. I don't want any of this money to be used for anything other than job creation and company formation. I like to say that, you know, we have 22 Fortune 500 companies, and they all started as a small company at one time. So that's what we're trying to do with this. So, Mr. Chair, if I could get a add to the amendment.
Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the A1 amendment to House File 102, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment passes.
Primary science and technology companies, there again, that's that list of 7,000 companies using the North American Industrial Classification. I did pass out that list that kind of gives you the, what those classifications mean. So 3241 is a petroleum coal products manufacturing. The last one, 541690, other scientific and technology, technical consulting services. A whole list of them. And 7,000 companies include sole proprietors or multiple employees. That just sets that up. I'll go to page 3, the section 3, Minnesota Science and Technology Fund. What this does is kind of track the money. Revenue collects it, hands it off to management and budget. Management and budget, upon warrant drawn by the commissioner or at the request of the executive director of the authority or the designee, can then release the money to these companies. Page 3, line 11, paragraph B, kind of sets the time frame when the commissioner of revenue will determine what that base was. So this is the year ending December 31st, 2011. It's 120 days after that. Paragraph C, starting on 317, defines that 85% of that of those taxes collected on any growth, and it also holds the fund to no more than $25 million in any one year. There is a revenue sheet that came out. The fund can grow fairly quickly. 2012, it's $7.2 million. 2013, it's 18. 2014, the projection is to get to 25 million. On 325, section 4, it does the powers and Minnesota Science and Technology Fund authorized uses. It pretty much lays out the powers and duties of the Science and Technology Authority. I can just read it. It established the commercialized research program. Line 33.30 established the Federal Research and Development Support Program. 3.32 established the Industry Technology and Competitive Program. Section 5 puts the meats on the bones of those last things I spoke to. Commercialized research program, or starts to put the meat on the bones. This commercialization of science and technology products, processes, or services from college and universities, nonprofit research institutions, which will lead to increase in science and technology business and jobs. This is the part that is for colleges and nonprofit research groups. You get to the next paragraph, paragraph one. Oh, I'm sorry. Paragraph two provides a funding of up to $250,000 for early stage development of qualified science and technology companies. It's just the reverse. Colleges quite often have good ideas and good research. They can't fund it. First paragraph funds it. Many companies have great ideas. They can't fund the research to bring it to market. paragraph 2 funds that. Now, this $250,000, it is not $250,000 or nothing. It can be $5,000 in loans or grants or whatever, or it can be up to $250,000, but it cannot be $250,000 plus one. So that is the limit. I think there was a question over here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swidensky.
Yes, Representative Mahoney. So 2014-2015 is expected the revenue is going to be about reach your max cap. What mechanisms are in place to address if there are, you know, 26? Where does those dollars go, or how does that process work?
Mr. Mahoney. That goes back to the general fund.
Okay.
Back to the bill. After paragraph 2, it lays out what is required. 416 is a written criteria. I like to call it a business plan. 418, matching funds are required. So if they grant $5,000, you'd have to come up with your own $5,000. If they grant $250,000, to come up with your own $250,000. Line 4.22 talks about you have to file a report at the end of the first year to tell this authority how you spent the money. Section 6, Federal Research and Development Support Program. Actually, this is something that many of you know or have heard me talk about. This is SBIR or STTR. And they're, those initials may mean nothing, but what they are, SBIR is Small Business Innovation Research, and STTR is Small Business Technology Transfer. And this calls for a match, a match to received SBIR and STTR awards of no more than $1.5 million. And I'd like to explain a little bit of that. Those are, the SBIR and the STTR are federal programs that go out and help small businesses start up. The federal government pours a lot of money out to that. And you'd be surprised, it is not Commerce, although they have part of that money. It is not the NIH. It is not the CDC. It is the Department of Defense that comes up with the most money to start these companies, because they're trying to commercialize products that can be brought to market, much like this, the Apollo project of the 60s. Changed the way America lived. That's what they try to do now. That $1.5 million may stick out, but that is still on the very, very low end of what the states that are involved in this process do. We have about a $10,000 grant, and we don't use much money on that in this state because we don't put much money into this. Other states that do, and having said that, over the last decade, the state of Minnesota collected, through these grants, or companies in the state of Minnesota collected, almost a quarter of $1 billion. But states that don't even match up to us in their science and technology, with a much more robust program for SBIR and STTR, collected almost $1 billion. That's federal money coming back to our states. We send 78 cents on the dollar to the federal government. We should get as much back as we possibly can, even if it costs us a little bit of money. So I'll move on to Section 7, which is an industry, innovation, and competitive program. What we're trying to do here is, I better get to my notes, otherwise I'll get too long. Gives the authority to establish, provide matching funds. Line 5.10, it provides matching funds for mentoring, counseling, technical services, and related activities. 5.14 funds initiatives that retain engineering, science, and technology, math occupations in the state. One of the things that we love to brag about is that we get a lot of kids that move to the Twin City area and around it, the surrounding areas, from North Dakota, from Iowa, from Madison.
Representative Mahoney, I hate to interrupt you, but we have World Lunar School of Chaska. We have some students in the back. Welcome to our committee. Appreciate you being here. You're what this is all about.
This is what we try to do. Because this is not a bill that at the end of this session creates 1,000 or 10,000 jobs. This is a bill that over the next 25 to 30 years creates new industries for the whole state of Minnesota, and not just in the urban area, but across the state. I'll get to that in a minute here. But as I was saying, one of the secrets that most people don't talk about is that we have some of the best programs at the University of Minnesota in engineering, chemical engineering, business school. Just as we recruit kids from Wisconsin, Iowa, and North Dakota, the East Coast and West Coast recruits kids from Minnesota. We need to retain those, because if you have bright people in your state, you will create wealth. And creating wealth creates jobs. When you create jobs, those pipe fitters can go make new buildings. And again, it gives the criteria and requires matching funds and it requires a report. Section 8. Section 8 is the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority's powers under the fund. This is something that we don't do very much of in Minnesota, and this is on top of page 6. Now, I'm going to read this so I don't make a mess of it. The authority may make awards in the forms of grants, loans, and charges, and charge and receive a reasonable interest for the loan, or take an equity position in the form of a stock or convertible note or other securities in consideration of an award. What this is trying to do, because this has a sunset clause in it, is we're trying to create the fund that can be self-sustaining. And it does go through the rest of much of that, awarding the money in the fund, promote collaboration between colleges. I will go to Section 9, which is a clawback. If somebody takes this money and moves out of state within a year or 2 years or 3 years, there's percentages that they have to repay back to the state. And Section 10 is the expiration date. And what I did with the expiration date is I made that the same as the Science and Technology Authority, because that ends after, not the Science and Technology Authority, but the Angel Investment Credit, because that ends after 7 years and comes up for renewal. So that this comes up at the same time. They have to either prove that they're worth and then come back to the Capitol and say, this is a good program, you should refund us. Or we didn't do our job and we'll see you later. Members, I will tell you that this plan, the one thing about this plan that I like, and one of the guiding principles that I had over the years that I've been doing on this committee with the chair, is that private business, I don't know what private business needs. I mean, I can kind of guess, and that's not the best way to do it. So the Science and Technology Authority has the five commissioners as the board, because the state requires that they be public employees or elected officials that deal with money. It has 19 people on the advisory committee, and we purposefully set it up so it would be almost a 2-to-1 margin of private business to public, and people who get their check from a public institution. The people who made this plan up represent companies like Cargill, Seagate, Thomson Reuters, the Defense Alliance, BioBusiness Alliance, Minsky, U of M, and some people from Deed, a variety of venture capitalists, small venture capitalists, because someone who's doling out $80 million doesn't really know what an entrepreneur needs. What an entrepreneur needs is somebody that kind of be there and help them through, give them advice on how to find a small company accountant or lawyer. Members, that's kind of my presentation. I'd like to bring down a couple of witnesses, if I could, testify to how this particular kind of bill would help them. So with that, I think Tim Mulcahy is here. And why don't you come on up and get another chair?
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record before you give your testimony, please. That way we know you were here 100 years ago.
Chair Gunther, thank you very much, and thanks for the welcome to the committee. My name is Tim Mulcahy. I'm the Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota, and I've spent about the last 3 years working with Representative Mahoney and other legislative leaders, as well as leaders of higher ed and our business community, to try to draft a strategic plan for the state of Minnesota, which is embodied in the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority. And let me just offer a couple of personal perspectives and my motivation for doing this, which I think is shared among all of us who've worked so hard on this. Minnesota enjoys a very enviable position in the national and international economy now, and that position has been really based on a very strong educational background, educational system, strong entrepreneurship and innovation over its history. Unfortunately, our position is not stable in the sense that there are a lot of other states who have seen how well Minnesota has done and recognizes that they need to do likewise, and have actually organized very successful and very competitive statewide plans to erode, if you will, the kind of position Minnesota has. And it would be bad enough if those states who I would say are behind us in this effort were the only ones we're competing with, but unfortunately there are some other states who've done an extremely good job in this for much longer than perhaps the new states who are in the hunt and are actually distancing the lead. So I've told people, and I use this joke a little bit, is that Minnesota needs to be aware that the competition is much like the warning we have on our rearview mirror on the car that says objects in the rearview mirror are closer than they appear. The nice thing about this effort, it really is an effort across all of the sectors in the state, the business sector, higher ed, and government, to actually develop an ecosystem for Minnesota. The state of Minnesota has made some very strong and important investments in the state and its economy and in its innovation workforce, but unfortunately we haven't really done it guided by what I would call a more general master plan that allows us to optimize the return on individual investments to make critical decisions about what is in the state's best interest overall. And so really what we need is an ecosystem that includes support for innovation, support for workforce development, a revenue support, a system to really provide early stage funding for entrepreneurs and innovative ideas. We need informed public policy, which is why we're really here working with you, confident that you'll help provide that backbone for the state. We need support for infrastructure, and we need support for education. The plan that's embodied in the Science and Technology Authority looks at all of those aspects, and I would refer you to the actual full report for greater detail. But the idea there is to really weave an effective ecosystem that addresses all these concerns. Last year, the legislature did took a very important first step in creating this ecosystem in support of the state with the passage of the Angel Investment Tax Credit, as Representative Mahoney has already mentioned. But that's just the first step in what will ultimately be a long process for the state to really get into a strong competitive position. I just point out to you that there are approximately 30 states in the union who have developed a strategy much like the ones that were talked about here. Representative Mahoney has already mentioned that there are very strong investments that these states have made in that capacity, certainly more than we're looking for at this point for this initiative. But what we really need, and what the state needs, is to actually provide a little lifeblood to this nascent new science and technology authority in a way that will allow it to really bring the right people together, the right array of programs together, such that Minnesota can establish a successful ecosystem that not only will maintain its place in the innovation economy, but actually will improve its position in this highly competitive area. The areas that are included in House File 102 were selected by the group of us that spent over a year working on drafting the strategic plan in response to the mandate from the legislature, were what I would call low-hanging fruit opportunities. We recognize the state has a very profound budget challenge. But I would say that what we need to do is begin to make careful, sizable investments in this process as we go forward. And we need this early stage funding to really get a foundation for what I think will be a more profound long-term strategy for the state. If you talk to entrepreneurs, if you talk to those who provide venture capital, if you talk to those of us in the universities who are dealing with innovation and challenges across getting innovative ideas in our universities to commercial products that would start new companies or support company growth, we will tell you the challenge comes in our ability to get the best and retain the best talent, and some of the issues that are addressed in this bill help there, to provide early stage high risk funding for promising ideas of relevance to the state when in fact the venture and angel investment categories are progressively more and more difficult to rely on for that kind of support, and also to provide leverage opportunities. And I'd like to point out that this bill really is talking about leveraging. It isn't simply a state investment, but using state dollars to leverage support from companies, leverage support from the universities, and most importantly, leverage support for very strong federal programs that as a state we have not really capitalized on the opportunity. So I'm here to say that this is the culmination of a very long process that has involved broad support from all sectors from the state, from members of all parties from the state, all here with one thing in mind, and that is Minnesota is number one. We want to succeed. We think we've put a foundation in place to really help the state be competitive in a very challenging time. I'm very supportive of this bill and would be happy to work with the committee to see it as it goes forward.
Thank you. Any Representative Swedinski?
Mr. Chair, question of mine kind of going into the area of repayment, Section 630. We talk about if the business itself would physically move without side of the borders of the state, is there anything that's going to address within this bill if some of the technology developed is proprietary in nature? So say if you've had a 5 or 6 person shop that developed something and they pretty much sell whatever they created within that same time period, essentially gutting the company, but they don't move, is there any clawback or would there be any option or openness to something like that?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, yes, actually, that clawback does cover that too.
Okay.
If they don't progress through that system and create their company, that clawback okay. comes into effect.
So if they just sold, if they created a widget that was proprietary and they sold it, then it would okay, perfect.
Correct.
And then also moving up to kind of the Section 514 initiatives to retain engineering, science, technology, and mathematical occupations in the state. Is there anything that kind of we were talking about gaining majors and helping folks to get involved in those specific majors. Are any of these dollars going to be going towards folks that are choosing that major or group within the university at all as far as grants or to individuals, or is that not part of this?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. That's good.
Mr. Chair, I have another, if there's no other questions, I have another witness, and actually, this is the first time I've met him, but I've heard of his company a good number of times, and I'm looking forward to his remarks, and I'll just leave him and introduce himself for the record and go ahead.
As are we. Would you give your name for the record, please?
My name is Robert Malachy.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your attention. I've been brought here as a witness to, I guess, how some of this funding has allowed our company to be successful and to the point where we are at. I'll give you, if you look in your packet, my presentation is on the right-hand side. So I won't go into great depth on the technology side, but basically we have developed some technology in the area of robotic vision that was thought to be about 5 to 10 years out. If we've bridged that gap to today, we've taken that technology and created the world's first optically based autonomous landing system for aircraft. It is the first system that can be implemented onto a small aircraft because it has virtually no weight added to the aircraft. and addresses a more than quarter of a billion-dollar problem that the federal government has currently today. Small UASs, which I'm sure you've seen in advertisements of the military where you see a soldier throwing this little, looks like a toy airplane, has become an integral part of the warfighter's mission. It collects valuable real-time reconnaissance and gives the commanders very good intel that is time-sensitive and allows them to make decisions that save lives. So the problem with these aircraft is that they do not have the capability to land precisely or safely. So they are crash-landed at a cost of about $250 million a year. They are not accurate in their landings. Their accuracy is measured in football field sizes. So when you see someone throwing a plane off the top of a building, there's no way he is ever going to recover that airplane on the top of that building. So soldiers' lives are put to risk when they have to go and recover these aircraft because they're not cheap assets. Typically, a small UAS, what I consider a kit, costs around $500,000. So basically, they are GPS guided. In the battlefield today, GPS is denied very easily by any capable opponent. So the government's been looking for methods for landing these aircraft that does not require GPS. And we have created basically what's considered a passive system that does not add any weight to the aircraft that can land these aircraft to within a 5-foot radius and recover it almost every single time. So what makes our technology very unique is that we are able to do it with a camera. We are able to determine an absolute three-dimensional orientation of an object in real time using two-dimensional imagery, which is not a trivial feat. Basically, this is rocket science, and it was considered to be impossible. In fact, you can read lots and lots of papers on why it should not be possible. We've achieved it. So I won't go into too much detail of how the technology works, but I'll go into the key milestones. In April, we demonstrated the world's first autonomous optical landing of an aircraft. There were several prime contractors who were in witness and very impressed. We've had several contracts with Lockheed Martin. We needed to take the technology to a higher TRL level. We were at a TRL level. TRL stands for technology readiness level. And SBIRs and SCTRs, which were discussed earlier, address technologies that are basically in their infancy, and they don't really assist in technologies that are closer to market. So we needed to raise money to develop the technology into a marketable product. So when we founded the company, there were four founders. We started the company with less than $10,000. We were able to get a technology grant from the state for $30,000, with a matching investment from the Norris Institute. Now, what was very important about this was that the state grant helped us basically woo an investor who basically saw it as an opportunity to kind of double their investment, and also gave us an opportunity to get more money without giving up too much equity. And you may think that $30,000 is not a huge amount. We also got a second $50,000, but what that equated to was around $225,000 that went into our pocket, where we were able to give up very little equity. And we took that money and we were able to develop the technology to a level where it became much more attractive to the companies and the government who is interested in saving this money or breaking into the market. Now, in 2010, we got a contract with a major, I wouldn't call them quite one of the top primes, but they're right in the second tier of prime contractors, to develop the technology for the U.S. Army, who has a huge problem with these small aircraft. So I haven't listed all the contracts we've done, because some of them I can't discuss. But we are now in discussions with a second large top-tier prime contractor, and we'll probably be doing test flights in June. Now, it may be misleading if you look at our website, because it looks like we're just a optical landing system for company for landing small aircraft and larger aircraft, but that's not true. We've been developing the technology in parallel to assess all the areas of robotic vision, and we are now developing four products, two of which will be coming to commercial fruition this year, one in the first quarter and one in the second quarter of 2011. I can't express how important the technology grant, matching grant, has been, because we started the company with four founders in my living room. $80,000 can go a long way when you're just four people trying to eke out a dream. So in 2008, we started with four founders. We are now at 10 employees, and we will be at up to 13 employees by the end of the first quarter of this year. 10 of those jobs are high-paying engineering positions. We've also managed to take on a few engineers from Lockheed Martin, who is closing their doors. I see that this technology is going to be something that will, is basically a technology that nobody has, nobody thought was possible, that can be expanded into so many markets, it almost boggles the imagination. And there's no way we would have ever been here without any of that money. So, I would say that the talents in this state are unparalleled. I am a veteran of the U.S. Air Force. I've worked with all the top-tier prime contractors. I was a linguist for the Air Force. I speak four languages fluently. I've traveled all over the world, and I've worked with engineers from Caltech, MIT, top engineers in the U.S. Army, and the engineers in my company are probably the best engineers I've ever worked with. We are developing technology that you would not believe. So, in conclusion, basically, you know, we have the talent here. We've got, you know, technology that can be applied beyond the borders of Minnesota, beyond the borders of this country, and can impact the lives of many people. And it sometimes doesn't take a whole lot of money to just make that possible. And I think we're a very good example of that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Robert. Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was impressed with the story. Thank you. My question is, did you go to any other venture capitalists prior to coming to this organization? If you could just run through kind of the path that you took to get here.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Raising money, especially in this environment, has been very difficult because, number one, we're not a medical devices company. And I think the state does need diversification in terms of the technology it pursues. If you talk to most venture capitalists, they're very interested in you if you're a medical device company. If you're a defense company, you're much higher risk. This is what I've encountered. Many of the angel investors I've worked with, they treat us like venture capitalists. They want to take all the company for a very low amount of money. I'm very happy to say that the four founders at this point still retain over 85% ownership in the company. We've been open for 2.5 years, going on our third year, and we have several contracts going, and we will be having positive cash flow this year. So it's been what would be considered angel investors are kind of moving more towards a venture capitalist model, and it's very onerous, some of the terms that they place on you. And my goal is to create jobs in Minnesota, stay in Minnesota. I like it here. I don't want to take the technology and, like, okay, go manufacture in China. You know, what I want to do is create technology that nobody else can build, and create jobs and build them here, and create basically a vibrant company here.
Mr. Chair, if I might. Mr. Chair and Representative, you're correct in to ask the venture capital path or the angel investment path. It is, at this particular point, most of the SBIR and the STTR is the ability to bring to market and still maintain control of the product. I don't want to say something bad about an investor, but if you've created the product, you have the zeal to make it into an earth-shattering, an earth-moving, a legacy for yourself. Once you start going down the path of venture capital and corporate backing and bank loans, it typically is taken away from you at an early stage, and you kind of lose that zeal. So that's where I would go with this.
Chair Gunther, I wonder if I could just add a moment here, too. And I would say that the university's experience with spinning out technologies at an earliest stage match this experience completely. It's very difficult these days with either angel investment alone or with venture capital alone that they would invest in a technology at its earliest, riskiest stage. And many of you have probably heard the reference to the term, you know, the valley of death, and that is that point at which a technology is established through early research and development but is not yet low risk enough for those who have funds to invest to take the risk personally. And what many of the states that we looked at with the 30 plus states, almost every single one of them have established a mechanism to provide early stage high risk support for promising technologies with that of relevance to the state in most cases. And our biggest challenge, spinning out our technologies to companies, is exactly the challenge to see that was referred to here. That earliest stage when you're going from a great idea to that first proof of principle where you can get a second tier and a first tier prime contractor to come in and say, boy, this looks promising enough that we're interested. Before that, it's a great idea, but come back to me when you got something new.
Yeah. Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Chair Gunther. Well, what a great story.
Thank you.
I mean, I think that this is the essence of why I wanted to be on this committee. And you know, everything has its place and time and how it can happen and how it puts together. I was just wondering, I'm not really questioning at all the bill or the success that the bill could bring to emerging technologies and inventors and entrepreneurs such as yourself, but aviation is my entire life, and I just wonder, have you assessed the applicability of this to commercial aviation?
Yes, we have.
And do you think that might be a significant, Mr. Chairman, do you think that might be a significant market in the future for this technology? And if so, do you think companies that produce commercial aviation products might locate in Minnesota because you have that technology? Or is this technology portable enough and easy enough to install at other manufacturing plants? Simple plug-and-play type stuff like a transponder or a GPS or something like that, the current aircraft. Kind of describe that. I'm really interested in that. Sorry to take up the committee time on that. This looks to me like a lead into a whole new, I mean, they got the technology, and I mean, I'm going to say something. I probably really get on the list with the pilots union. But I used to own an airline, and you could run one hell of an airline if you didn't have to deal with the pilots because they're.
And he's got the money.
I'm not in the business anymore, and I don't negotiate with the union anymore.
Mr. Chair, representatives, this technology is it has applications well beyond aviation, not only in the commercial market. This technology allows for precise guidance in very tight quarters. It's never been possible before at all. This could allow for robotic refueling, robotic landings, dockings, all sorts. It's also applicable to underwater, the emerging underwater, unmanned underwater craft. It's also applicable to automobile industry. The applications are so vast. The problem is that we just don't have the resources to pursue all of them at the same time. So we have to basically figure out which ones we can utilize early, the lower hanging fruit, and address those first, and then expand as we can.
One last question.
Sure.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Gunther. You know, I having said what I said, you know, probably will never be a time And that's a big, big time that you won't have passenger flights that are captained and crewed by human beings. But one of the things back in the days that I was in the industry, I always thought about this, never knowing how to achieve it. No, even an idea. It was like Buck Rogers, so to speak. But cargo flights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, that is so intriguing to me that you know, think of the vast amount of cargo that moves in this country and what efficiency we could bring with precise guidance, landing, and all of that. That just is totally intriguing to me. And again, you know, Minnesota is very, very well located to have another airport maybe even that dealt nothing with flights of that nature. So anyway, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Representative Lattier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, I'm not convinced about supporting this bill yet. I still have some additional questions. And the reason is because there's other sources of funding that are out there. I mean, another question I would have is, for instance, the federal loan programs and the small business, what are they called? Small Business Association or whatever that they provide funding in. And the rules have for those programs have allowed for, it's really opened up. The program has opened up quite a bit. So there's other sources of funding. We've talked about venture capital. We've talked, I didn't hear anybody comment about the federal government programs for funding. This same, your company could conceivably have launched with that. Did you try that source?
Representative, we do have some of those small business loans. We do have, we've explored all of our options. I've had very good advisors from the University of Minnesota, from the deed office, and also from the University of St. Thomas. We have explored and pursued every option that we could. This just happened to be one that we did explore and did prove to be quite a lifesaver.
If I may offer a response as well, there are a number of federal programs intended to enhance conversion of technology to commercial products that would benefit the country, but benefit states. One of the issues with them is when you talk about small business loans or small business programs, those really, for the most part, address an established business, which actually, although maybe not making a lot of money or having a lot of product out there, it is a business that delivers a product. Most of what we're talking about here are early stage technologies which could support a company at some point, but are so early in the development that there is not a company that could apply for a small business loan. The other thing I would say is some of these federal programs are highly competitive, and when we've looked through the state of Minnesota and looked at other states, what we realize is for our entrepreneurs, our innovators in the state, to be successful at getting those funds, which we should be pursuing very aggressively, they need help in how to understand the system, how to write effective proposals, and in many cases, there's a requirement for some kind of match or leverage. And our innovators in the state have reported to us it's very difficult for them to find sources. So one of the things I would point out is that the intent of a science and technology authority when it's actually operating would be to provide leverage, not to say to a company, we will give you everything you need, but we will give you assistance and help you tap into the other kind of sources that are available. Right now, there's a dearth of that kind of expertise and the networking in the state to support that kind of leveraging activity.
Thank you. Representative Sanders, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, again, congratulations. Wish you nothing but the best and continued success. Representative Mahoney, I do have a question on Subdivision 11. It seems written broadly enough, but I guess I just want to clarify. Do we have the door here open for folks that may specialize or want to move into computer science or technology, bio, robotic? How wide open is this? What types of of companies are we going to be able to help? Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders, what page and line?
That is, Mr. Chair, page 2 starts on 2.3, subdivision 11, qualified science and technology company. I'm just wondering, you know, what types of companies, I mean, it seems written pretty broadly, so I just want to make sure that if we've got a bio company that wants to get going, if we've got robotics, if we've got, you know, further computer technology or science, you know, who applies?
Mr. Chair, it essentially works along the same lines as the angel investment credit. I think there's only like four things that are prohibited, and one of them is I don't know the example. I don't want to give examples because I might make a mess. But yes, that we've written this broad enough that if you have a high-tech science-based idea, high-tech manufacturing, that you can take advantage of this particular program. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I did not kill a bunch of trees and bring a copy of the report for each and every one of you, but let me read the six focused areas that they want to focus in on this particular program. Aerospace and defense, agriculture, food and forestry, biotechnology and life sciences, fuels, energy and energy management systems, information and computer technology, mining, materials, manufacturing, and processing. So we've tried to keep this as broad as possible, and I will make sure that everyone gets a link to this particular report. I recommend the executive summary before you dig into the 40 or 50 pages, knowing how busy we are, but it does give you some sense of that.
Representative Swininski.
Yes, I would like to submit an amendment to House File 102 as follows. On page 6, line 33, after state, insert or cease operation in Minnesota. On page 6, line 34, after state, insert or ceases operation in Minnesota. And on page 7, line 1, after relocates, insert or ceases operation in Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney.
Seems like a friendly amendment to me.
Okay. With that, everybody understand the amendment? I think the author approves it. I think we, instead of incorporating, we'll have to vote. All in favor of the written amendment by Representative Swininski, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment passes. And with that, any other questions? I think we're looking forward to our next testifier. We enjoyed this one very much. Thank you very much for coming here. You give us hope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 102 as amended be passed and sent to taxes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair.
You.
Thank you, committee member.
Now we have Commissioner Phillips, indeed, coming forth. Oh, yeah, we should approve our minutes. Did anybody thoroughly read the minutes from February 24th?
There's that needs to be a correction again there. I'd like to approve them with amended that Tony Sertich again did attend.
Good point. Carly, were you here then on the 20th? Were you here on the 24th?
Yes.
So we should insert her name.
Yes.
She is.
Oh, is she? Okay. We just get rid of okay. With that correction, is there any other corrections in a minute? Kaminsky moves the minutes of February 24th as amended. All in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're just getting our technology hooked up here.
Isn't that wonderful stuff?
I'll introduce myself, and I have some of my team here. I'm Mark Phillips. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I will lead things off, and then, as I say, as we get through our various departments, we may bring different people up here, and we'll introduce them at the appropriate time. So we're here today to talk about the department's budget, so I'll just begin as soon as we get this up. Again, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the first slide we have up talks about our mission and goals, and I know I made an overview, but I just want to remind the committee members that our mission is to support the economic prosperity of individuals, businesses, and communities by improving opportunities for growth, and our goals are to create and retain jobs, cultivate entrepreneurship, enhance community vitality, strengthen the workforce, foster self-sufficiency, and address economic change. Okay, our agency budget, we're looking at the fiscal year 12-13. Our funding sources, as you can see, is dominated by federal funding, almost $600 million. General fund is about 9% of our budget. I won't run through all these. We have the Workforce Development Fund, which is funded by our unemployment payroll tax, and other funding that comes through revolving funds that we have available for department use.
Mr. Chair.
Mrs. Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we go on, I just want to, I'm new to this committee, but I have a question about the Workforce Development Fund. So that comes from the Workforce Development Assessment, or does it come from other sources as well on the unemployment tax?
Commissioner.
Primarily funded by the, there's 12/100ths of a percent on the first $27,000 of payroll that's collected through the unemployment tax system, and that's the primary driver for the Workforce Development Funds.
And as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, Mr. Phillips, then also, do all businesses pay that assessment, or are there some businesses that do not? And how would that be quantified between the...
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to bring Keith Goodwin, who is the director of our unemployment insurance area, just to make sure I get that accurate.
Keith Goodwin, director of the unemployment insurance program. Taxpaying employers, not reimbursing. So governmental units do not pay it. 501c3s do not pay it. So it's about 2 million employees in the state of Minnesota that it's assessed on that payroll.
Thank you. And then as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, prior to 2009, that assessment was 0.1, and then it's a temporary addition to the 0.12 from 2009 until June 30th of 2011. So are you anticipating dropping that back down to 0.1, or are you anticipating some type of legislation to keep it at 0.12?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as of right now, I anticipate that that will fall back to 0.1 at this time. Whether people are contemplating legislation, I'm not sure of that.
Okay, thank you.
And members, we will try to hold the questions. We'll answer those on Thursday. That way we can finish the presentation today and get the questions on Thursday. Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll continue. If there's no other questions on the sources of funding, the budget, the agency-wide budget by expenditures is, as you will see, unemployment insurance, looking at the upper left of the chart, is that's the operations. That is not the payments out of the trust fund. Obviously, that's a much larger number if we included the payments. So this is operating the unemployment system. Again, going counterclockwise, the business and community development, you'll see, is about 14% of the budget. Workforce development is about 67%, or about $549 million, and then general support services, about 4%. We have four operating divisions within DEED, business and community development, workforce development, unemployment insurance, and then general support services. So I'm going to turn this over just for briefly to Mark Loftus, who's the Division Director of Business and Community Development, to run through the next few slides.
Very well. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm the Director of the Business and Community Development Division at DEED. I'll put this slide up first, and then I won't go into detail on each of the elements of this pie chart, but you'll note, of course, that the federal funds by dollar represent the biggest portion of our funding that comes into the department. But you'll also note, as we get into the presentation, that we are heavily dependent on a general fund for much of our operations and staff. I would also point out at this, early in the presentation, that our division is the smallest operating division in terms of both staff and in terms of funding. We are the smallest portion of the department with and actually 56.9 positions within our budget. And if you'll ask me where the 0.9 comes from, I'll tell you it's a combination of, we actually have 56 people. The 0.9 represents us contracting for other services in the department with other staff, so that shows up as part of an FTE, a little bit of overtime in there, so that's where those numbers come from. And I should also tell you, too, that these numbers represent the governor's and throughout our presentation, the governor's proposed budget, which includes recommended cuts as well, which, of course, the legislature will have to act on. So when you see these numbers, and as I talk about some of the proposed cuts, you'll see those in here. But those are not base budget. Those are proposed cuts in some cases. So turning to the next page, I'm going to go through this by office within our division. The first one is the Business Development Office. We have 13.5 positions. And this is the office within state government that connects to businesses in a proactive way to help encourage job growth and investment and locational decisions in the state. We have staff who are located in St. Paul, but we also have staff located at six offices in regions around the state. We also have staff that are focused on industry assignments. Most of our funding in the general fund is for staff costs, personnel-related costs. But there is a small portion of that general fund number for the biennium. And this, again, these are biennial budget numbers. That also represents the funding for the Biobusiness Alliance is in that portion. And I'll talk about that a little bit later as well. Special revenue fund is funds that we collect from organizations who help us go to trade shows around the country, things like the biotech trade show and the wind energy show. And our Positively Minnesota donations are small contributions that organizations make who are part of our marketing partnership. And as you see on the slide, there are a number of expansions, even in our down economy, that we've worked with in the past year. And a notable example in the past year was Sage Electrochromics. Sage is a great company down in Faribault. They've got their first real start in Faribault, and now they're growing. The legislature has done some specific things to help them move that forward, and it's a good illustration of how we can partner with local governments, with the counties, with the utilities, with the regional organizations, Minnesota Chamber, all in moving toward the direction of trying to encourage investment to go forward. I might also mention that when we talk about marketing Minnesota at events outside the state, last year we did participate at 11 events, and you might say, well, what do those things yield? And the fact is, as an example, you may have seen last week there was actually a press conference here at the Capitol, over across the street at the Capitol in the rotunda, for a company from Coon Rapids called BioVest. BioVest has had a long-time presence in Minnesota and working on cell cultures for the Department of Defense. But we learned at a biotech show 2 years ago while we were there that they had major plans for expansion in getting into developing a vaccine for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the first of its kind ever. And it was at that trade show that we really began to understand that they had plans to expand somewhere, and it was potentially either Tampa, Florida, where their parent company was, or where they had this operation in Coon Rapids. And for the last 2 years, we've been working with them to make that happen. Used our Minnesota Investment Fund program, but a very good success and a great illustration of the bioscience sector here in Minnesota growing, and we're very excited about that one. So let me move next to the entrepreneurship.
Yeah, interrupt, Mr. Chairman. I just want to point out that on the upper right corner of each slide, we put the corresponding pages in your budget book that you have in front of you so that you could tie this back and forth. If you're making notes for questions, you can actually refer to your budget book page if you need to. So
the next slide is about our entrepreneurship and small business efforts. There's really three principal uses of our funding here. The first is the assistance that we provide to the nine state small business development centers around the state. They provide free counseling one-to-one for small businesses or people that are thinking about going into a business. We provide direct assistance to small businesses from our office. Our staff are on the phone all day long answering calls. How do I incorporate a business? Do I need a permit to do the following thing? We provide the Guide to Starting a Business, which is a great publication that we've been producing for probably 24 years now running. And I also just produced a book on angel tax credits that's going to be a good resource as well. And we also, in this office, administer what we call pass-through grants to other organizations. And I'll kind of be more specific about these funds here. First of all, in the general fund area, $950,000 of that is the operations of the Small Business Assistance Office. $1.2 million represents funds that go to the nine small business development centers. There's also funds in here for staff administration. But as far as the pass-through organizations, there are three in the general fund. One is for MEDA, which is a group here in the Twin Cities. MEDA stands for Metropolitan Economic Development Association. Women Venture, which is based in St. Paul and serves primarily women entrepreneurs, and the Minnesota Inventors Congress, based in Redwood Falls. We put on the annual Inventors Congress and help individual and potential and potential inventors. Those funds are within the general fund portion. Now, when we talk about the entrepreneurial pass-throughs, that third category, that represents funds that come from the Workforce Development Fund. The legislature in the past has allocated funds to the following organizations from the Workforce Fund. That would be MEDA, with $100,000, the Center for Rural Policy at $200,000, and the Riverbend Enterprise Facilitation Programs for $378,000. Those are biennial budget numbers. So it's kind of tricky here, a combination of general fund dollars for some of the pass-throughs, workforce funds for some of the pass-throughs, and the federal money also is a largely $3.4 million for small business developments in our operations. The federal SBA gives us money that we pass through to the regional SBDCs, as their acronym is known. And we also got around $400,000 this last year for additional funds that they're flowing from the federal government, from the Small Business Act last year, to these local centers. So that's in sum total the, you can see some of the metrics there of the assistance that's been provided or accomplished in those areas. Next category is the Jobs and Business Finance Group. And this is, if you look in the budget books, this is 6.6 positions, but because of the quirks of our system, it's actually 9 people in this office. These positions, or some of these positions, are also supported by our federal dollars we get from Community Development Block Grant Program. And that's accounted for in the community finance section that follows here. As you look at some of these funds, let me just kind of generalize and say that the special revenue funds represent loan repayments that we get from a variety of sources. And those are the primary source that we have of future lending. At present, we don't have any general fund appropriations that we use to lend out, any new general fund appropriations. We're kind of living off of past appropriations and revolving funds. Most of our funds that we provide are in the form of low-interest loans. But in some cases, we provide what we call forgivable loans. In the case of a project like Sage Electrochromics, it was in competition for other among other states to have that location occur. We provide those forgivable terms when the goals are achieved, job goals are achieved, and that loan is forgiven. And also within this office, we have the Angel Tax Credit Program that we're very excited about. You heard testimony earlier how important that is. 66 firms between August and December last year got assistance under the program, and one other interesting fact is that 27% of the investors are from outside Minnesota, which is a really, really nice feature, I think, a nice outcome to have. As you look at the general fund here, most of those funds are devoted to staffing. Most of the special revenue funds are really two major sources, our Minnesota Investment Fund, which is $2.5 million, the Urban Initiative Fund, which is $1.6 million, and then some smaller funds from smaller programs, and I can identify those if you like. The septic on-site septic loan program is represents funds from the Federal Clean Water Fund. We get a $100,000 appropriation from that for replacement of failing septic systems on resorts, on lakes principally. And we only did 2 loans in the last 2 years, but I learned today that we have another one queued up up in Hackensack. So we may be making one more loan out of this year, but a small program. And the federal category there is of $10,400,000 is a new fund. The federal government last year made available something called the Small Business Credit Initiative Program. And Minnesota is eligible to apply for $15.4 million that we can use over a 3-year period. We are in the process, we have until June to submit a proposal, and we're in the process of collecting ideas on how those funds might be used. We can do direct loans, we can do loan guarantees, we conceivably might even be able to do venture capital in some fashion, but we have a little time to work on that, and that is new money. In total, it'll be $15 million, but this is a 2-year biennial expenditure. And finally, I should mention, too, that this office, because of its name, you would suspect, administers the JobZ program, and if you've been in the legislature before, you know that we've placed a lot of effort in the last couple of years to Representative Mahoney is enjoying this, I think. A lot of time trying to reshape the program and place more scrutiny on the individual projects that are done. We have a scoring system and determination of the return on investment, a lot more oversight of the program. And there is no budget cost in our budget for the JobZ exemptions. That's part of the Department of Revenue's budget. So, Next area, community finance, is the, you know, what I've talked about so far are our business development programs, business finance, small business, larger businesses. The point of economic development is also that we need strong communities to be in place. We need communities where businesses can make investments and flourish and succeed there. So we do things like spending money on contamination site cleanup. We tear down dilapidated structures. We help with infrastructure that goes into industrial parks so businesses can locate there. We help renovate low-income housing. We help rehabilitate commercial business districts. So those are all kind of flowing through all of these activities in these funds. General fund dollars here are mostly cleanup funds, which are used primarily for grants but also for administration. The federal dollars of $65 million represent $61 million from our federal community development block grant program that we use for our small cities program for low-income housing and commercial rehabilitation projects. And there's also some small funds from the EPA and some hazardous waste fees that make up the difference there. Special revenue funds are some Environmental Protection Agency revolving funds and some cleanup tax dollars that we collect. And the petroleum tank release and remediation funds both go into the contamination cleanup program. There's a change item related to the petrol fund just a bit later in one of our slides. But there are some really good examples around the state of projects, and I just noted a couple from our long list. On the east side of St. Paul, the Baldinger Bakery project is the result of the cleanup of the Griffin Wheel site. Many ways of investing in that site to help prepare it for new development. There was a project in Norwood Young America, I think, in your district, Representative Leidiger. The Oak Grove Dairy was a redevelopment project and has led to some new community centers and library activity development in that area as well. And in Minneapolis, the Longfellow Rail Station was another example of a project that came out of some of those cleanup funds. So you see some of the measures overall in the last years. And next office is the Minnesota Trade Office, and I'm going to defer to Katie Clark, who's the director of that office, and let her talk about the work that her office
does. Welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to present today. I'm Katie Clark, the executive director of the Minnesota Trade Office. Our office general fund covers 14 positions, based mostly personnel costs, computers and systems, and different supplies. Special revenue covers the trade missions, governor-led trade missions, as well as all the training programs that we host throughout the year. The companies that do decide to travel on those trade missions or participate in our training programs pay their own fees to attend. The Minnesota Trade Office, over the course of 2010 and through February 23rd, responded to almost 1,200 requests for export technical assistance from 587 companies across the state. We're focused on supporting small to mid-sized companies. We conducted 104 site visits to 91 companies to provide export consulting and led 43 seminars and roundtables to educate 969 business leaders. Many of these businesses are new to exporting, but many of the companies have been exporting over the years but are looking to enter new international markets and need some country-specific information. In 2010, Minnesota's total manufactured good exports totaled close to $19 billion. Canada remains our top export market. Almost a third of our manufactured goods are exported to Canada, and China is our second market since 2005 when it hit $1 billion and now is close to $2 billion in exports. The Trade Office also organized a governor-led trade mission last year to China and Japan and led 59 businesses and academic leaders on that trade mission. And we hosted 68 visiting foreign delegations and connected them with Minnesota companies across the state. And then 2 weeks ago, the Trade Office opened our first satellite office in partnership with St. Cloud State University in St. Cloud as a way to better outreach to small to mid-sized companies in that region of the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll continue on with the discussion about our change items, and there's two slides that relate to this. The first one is the cuts that our division will take, is proposing to take, as a result of the reduction in that are proposed in the budget. This is a biennial number. It would be $376,000 for our division's operations. That represents one and a half positions. The one full-time position is a staff person in the field in central Minnesota. We're going to have to consolidate staff. That person has accepted an early retirement program, so we're going to have to consolidate regional assignments and fill the gap there. Will also mean reduced operating expenses for us and things like marketing and participating in some of those innovative things that we sometimes would like to do. So those are some of the reductions that we'll take. That number, $376,000, represents a 2.4% of the general fund base budget of our division. And as you see on that slide also, I referenced earlier the Petro Fund. Currently, the fee that is assessed to underground tank or companies that have underground tanks on their site is scheduled to sunset in 2012, and we're going to propose legislation to have that continue on through 2017. The Petroleum Association here in the state has for a long time supported this program as a use of those petrol fund dollars, and we are recommending continue on so they continue the great work that is done around the state. And in this last slide, for me, are the change items in our budget pass-throughs. And these numbers represent the proposed cuts. First of all, the BioBusiness Alliance, after its $238,000 biennial budget cut, would have $712,000 in general fund funding. Women Venture would be cut $100,000, leaving them $300,000 for the biennium. MEDA, the Metropolitan Development Association here in Twin Cities, would be cut $52,000, leaving $158,000 for the biennium. And the Inventors Congress would be cut $26,000, leaving $74,000 for the biennium. And those cuts represent 2.7% of our overall operating funds. And I should also say, under the governor's recommendations, MEDA's $100,000 from the workforce fund would not be cut. So that would stay as it is. So they have a combination of general fund and workforce development dollars. Mr. Chairman, I have contacted all of these organizations and let them know that this is coming as a recommendation. I encourage them to seek out the committee and make their concerns known about these. I could just add an aside that our economic development budget has been cut for a long time, and none of us are happy about these cuts or the potential of these cuts. But we have to make some cuts somewhere, and we're trying to preserve the core of our economic development program that we have in our department, and also keep these pass-through groups with some funding so that they can continue on the very good work that they do. Mr. Chairman, that's my last slide. If you think.
Mr. Who we got next?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to call Bonnie Elsie up to talk about our workforce development budget.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Elsie, Director of the Workforce Development Division of DEED. The very first slide, I want to talk just briefly about it, but we'll get into the majority of it further on in the presentation. The federal funds are the majority, as you see, 72% of our budget, and they come from three federal departments. The majority come from the Department of Labor, the second largest is from the Department of Education, and the smallest amount comes from the Department of Human Services. Our Workforce Development Fund, I think all of you know what that is, but from that fund is the majority goes to dislocated worker programs, and otherwise the rest of it goes through pass-throughs. The Special Revenue Fund has Special services for displaced homemakers is in that fund is an assessment on marriage license and divorce license so that you can provide services to displaced homemakers. And also there's some fees in there from state services for the Blinds Communication Center. Our general fund, the majority of the general fund, as you will see as we go on, over half of it is match money to draw down the federal dollars for vocational rehabilitation. First, we'll talk about different offices that I have under my division. Business services. The general fund dollars under business services are all in the Job Skills Partnership Board. Those funds primarily go to train incumbent workers, and they usually go to some educational institution that works with a business and customized training for their workers. The purpose of that, of course, is to develop curriculum that doesn't currently exist, that is needed by business. The federal programs, I can tell you, all of our federal programs have federal mandates. So the money that we get from the feds have specific populations we're supposed to serve and have specific criteria, rules, and regulations on what we do with the money. Under the federal programs under business services, we are mandated to provide a labor exchange system. And part of that labor exchange system is an employer and job seeker job bank. So the employer side of it and the work that we do with businesses is under this particular area. The other federal funds that we receive under business services is money for a tax credit program. And also for foreign labor certification program. The business services specialist staff we have in the workforce centers have contacted over 9,000 businesses this past year. And what they specifically do is HR consulting. They try to find out if the company's going to expand, if they've got the right, if the company has the right kind of skilled workers, if they have any recruitment needs, or if they're having problem in retaining employees. And they work with businesses to try to keep their workforce skilled and also employed. The Minnesota Works, I did talk about that in this committee before, but that is our state job bank. And on any given day, we have about 63,000 resumes and about 26,000 job orders, or job openings. Last year, we had a total of 408,665 job openings. And of those, 66% of the employers who posted the jobs on our job bank said that they actually hired somebody from our job bank, so a customer of ours that was in our job bank. The Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program trained over 10,000 workers and leveraged, and this is really important, they leveraged $15 million in private investment. So the company matches whatever they can when they draw down a grant. The Adult Services is one of our largest offices, many different funding sources. The general fund is typically all pass-throughs. It's programs like Northern Connections, Twin Cities Rise, LifeTrack Resources. Our federal money is job service, again, Wagner-Peiser money, which must be delivered with state employees. They must be state merit staff. We also have the Trade Adjustment Act, which also must be delivered by state merit staff. Veterans program is the same. We also have, under the federal program, Career One-Stop program. And we have the Adult, Youth, and Dislocated Worker programs under WIA. We do not deliver those ourselves. We are partners with the workforce service areas who deliver the dislocated worker, youth, and adult programs at the local level in one of our 49 workforce centers. They also deliver a lot of the state dislocated worker program that comes out of the Workforce Development Fund. And so the Workforce Development Fund includes pass-throughs as well as the dislocated workers, pass-throughs such as LifeTrack Resources, Opportunities Industrial Centers, Twin Cities Rise, Northern Connections are some of the recipients that have been earmarked for these funds through the legislature. Special revenue, like I said before, most of that revenue is for the Displaced Homemaker Program and is fees on marriage licenses and divorce. And there's also money in there from under special revenue from a contract that we have with the Department of Human Services for the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is TANF. During calendar year 2010, more than 284,000 job seekers visited one of our 49 local workforce centers, and with the recession going on, they visited many times. So we were happy to be able to serve those people who were in need. We also serve 30,646 people in the Dislocated Worker Program, and that's including both state and federal funds. And we place people, and four out of five of those people were able to get jobs that paid over $40,000 a year. Our youth programs. Our federal program, the youth program, is a year-round program. And so under the federal amount of $30 million includes both the WIA youth program and the Youth Build Program. And the Youth Build Program is a program that the feds do a solicitation for a grant announcement themselves, and they select the providers within the state of the Youth Build Program. From the Workforce Development Fund under the youth programs, we have a number of pass-throughs. We have more money coming out of that for the Youth Build Program. We also fund the Minnesota Youth Program, which provides employment for disadvantaged youth in the summer. Also, the Minneapolis gets a allocation for their youth, as well as St. Paul. And out of there also comes funding for the Boys and Girls Club. And I think that's basically what comes out of the Workforce Development Fund. The youth provides employment and training services for approximately 10,000 of Minnesota's neediest youth, and what we really mean by that is in this population are at-risk youth, at risk of dropping out of high school. In the WIA youth program, the year-round program, we also work with out-of-school youth, kids that have already dropped out of school that are in the juvenile justice system, and work to get them basic living skills as well as basic literacy skills that are needed in order to gain a skill and become employed. In the Minnesota Youth Program, youth on public assistance, and like it says, in foster care and juvenile offenders, we're very proud of our youth program because we, on the WIA Youth Program nationally, we are one of the top servers of people with disabilities and people from the juvenile justice system and from the foster care system. So we're very proud that we really are reaching the hardest to serve youth. The next program that I'm going to talk about is the next slides will have to do with serving people with disabilities. I know earlier Kim Peck, the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation, did present in front of this committee. So I'm just going to briefly go over the funding area of the vocational rehabilitation. The majority of the money that is in the general fund here is used to draw down federal dollars. Every dollar in state money draws down $3.7 in federal. And we need to be able to draw down as much money as possible because one of the things that we never have enough money to serve all the people who need our help in vocational rehabilitation. And one of the things that we know for sure is that it is our mission to serve the hardest to serve first. So that most of the people that we serve have significant disabilities because we don't have enough money to serve everybody. And that's the priority of service that's required in the federal regulations. We anticipate that we will serve about 21,900 individuals each year. The federal money that we get is $91 million, and that is our grant award. And in that is also some Social Security earnings. We are able to, when we place an individual on a job and they were a recipient of Social Security, we are able to get reimbursed for the cost that it took us to retrain that individual and place them in jobs. So we do have some revenue coming in from the Social Security Administration. Another part of the same legislation at the federal level is our state services for the blind. Some states have a combined agency. We have two separate agencies, one for the blind and one for all other disabilities. The majority of the money in the general fund under state services for the blind is used again for match, and the rest of it funds the senior services and our communication center. I think a lot of you are aware of our communication center. It does braille and audio for people who are blind or visually impaired. We also have a contract to do braille with the K-12 system so that anybody who has a visual impairment can receive those services for us. We will do their textbooks or what other kinds of literature that a teacher needs for the student. Our federal grant award, and this comes from the Voc Rehab Act, but specifically to Voc SS or State Services for the Blind, is $21 million. We have special revenue. We do charge fees in the Communication Center for some braille that's done for the general public, and also that we do have some special revenue coming in under our blind vendor program. We also get gifts in the Communication Center. There are people who gift money to us, and we get about $290,000 for the biennium there. We serve about 3,600 blind or visually impaired seniors every year and produce about 1 million pages of braille. Extended employment, a very important program in order for people with disabilities to be in the labor force. It's an ongoing job support program to employed persons with significant disabilities. From the general fund, the extended employment program gets about $14 million, and that includes money going to Rise Inc. and from the Workforce Development Fund, another $14 million. And some of those are pass-throughs to Rise Inc., Deaf and Hard of Hearing, which is the Vector program, and the majority goes to extended employment, and extended employment is actually delivered through 28 community rehab partners that we have across the state of Minnesota. We serve over 6,100 Minnesotans, and they actually worked 4.3 million hours and earned more than $28 million in wages. Independent living. We have eight independent living centers across the state of Minnesota, and the general fund funds about $4 million in the biennium, and the federal money for independent living centers is almost $6 million. It serves 7,655 people, and over 150 Minnesotans relocated each year from nursing home settings back to their home because they learned the type of skills that are necessary to live independently. Another office within my division is disability determination, and this we actually determine whether or not an individual is eligible for Social Security disability. And that is a direct federal program. It is run through our department at $68 million a year, or the biennium, I should say. It provides determinations, like I said, for people that are applying for Social Security disability. And we do about 50,000 determinations every year. We don't actually pay out the Social Security disability. That comes directly from the Social Security Administration, but we make the determinations.
Okay, members. Hold on. Well, you haven't finished?
No. I have the largest division.
You do. You get to change items, that's right.
Yeah. Representative Gunther and members of the committee. Now I want to talk about our change items. Since we have very little general fund, one of the programs that we are cutting is the Job Skills Partnership Program. So much of our federal funds, I mean state general funds, like I talked about before, draw down federal funds. So we didn't really want to cut the match in vocational rehabilitation or state services for the blind, as it would impact our ability to get federal money. So the Job Skills Partnership Program is one. We are also asking for an increase in our federal match for vocational rehab and state services for the blind. $4 million for the biennium to be able to draw down $3.7 of federal funds, and $300,000 for state services for the blind. Based on the projections that we are getting from the Department of Education, the Rehabilitation Administration, they give us about the amount of money that we will get in as our allocation, and we cannot draw those down unless we have more match money. So that's why we are requesting that. Cuts, always the hardest part, is our pass-through grants, and where we are cutting is through our general fund. We are recommending elimination of funding to Minnesota Diversified Industries. Not that they don't do a good job, it's just that they don't meet the kinds of goals that we have of placement in unsubsidized employment and at a prevailing wage. So we are cutting that particular program. Twin Cities Rise, the rest of them are cutting 10%. Twin Cities Rise would be $70,000. They also receive money, and that's from the general fund. All of these are general fund cuts. They are also receive money from the Workforce Development Fund, which we are not cutting, and they also receive federal earmark money from Department of Labor. Advocating Change Together, a 10% cut to the general fund, which is $30,000 for the biennium. Rise Inc., $30,000. Northern Connections, $30,000. Life Track, $20,000. Northern Connections and Life Track also get money from the Workforce Development Fund, as does Rise Inc. I want you to just move ahead to page 31, because this basically impacts a couple of the programs that Mark Loftus has under business and community development, and all of
the Elsie, I think our time is up in 3 minutes.
Okay.
So we're going to continue this in our next meeting. I want everybody to put this document in their save folders, and we will get your question on Thursday. And with that, Commissioner, thank you very much so far. We'll continue it Thursday.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.